So tell us a little bit about Cross Culture Ventures and what it is you guys focus on.
Yeah, so Cross Culture is a three-year-old venture capital firm with culture at the heart of everything we do. So what that means for us is we study consumer behavior through culture, global culture, and in particular, subcultures like Black and Latinx communities in the U.S., which tend to be the drivers of global culture in general. And we do this to try to figure out where consumers are going to spend their capital in the future and then bet on companies that are building solutions that are, you know, are poised to ride those trend waves.
Was that lane a deliberate decision? You know, when you designed, like when the company was being birthed, did you say, hey, we want to do this? And if so, why?
Yeah, we came around to it. It's kind of a roundabout way. Before I started Cross Culture, I was at Intel Capital, and I helped orchestrate and launch their diversity fund. So I want to see more diversity in tech and venture and all that stuff. But I didn't want to do it in a way where we're labeling entrepreneurs and CEOs as diversity founders, right? Or putting some tag on their back that makes them different than any other founder. So I wanted to dig a little bit deeper and try to understand, well, what makes diversity so important? What is it about diversity that, you know, creates hyper growth for companies? What is it about diversity that makes teams more high performing than other teams? And it came down to culture. And so we started to study that more. You know, from culture, you get kind of behavioral norms, and you get habits, and you get all these activities.
So culture is a word that gets thrown around a lot. So how does Marla Nichols define the term culture?
It's that thing that you can't see, you can't feel, but it just moves you in ways that you don't understand.
Beautifully stated. Thank you. For that.
Yeah, you can clap.
Everybody applaud. So you recently sort of, there's a phrase I love that you've been using is culture as currency, yeah. Right? And I think when you think about venture capital and startups and so on and so forth, it doesn't readily associate. So I would love for you to kind of like pontificate upon what culture as currency means.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the companies that we invest in, and we have 24 companies in our portfolio today over the last 3 years. But most of them are market creators as opposed to just following in on what everyone else is doing. And so when I think about diverse cultures and our communities, like we spend 30% more of our income on technology and consumer products. We're early adopters of technology, but no one's building technology for our communities and the challenges that are within our communities. So when we talk about culture as currency, it's kind of a call to look within our communities and find those challenges that have yet to be solved and build companies that can solve those. And what will end up happening is you'll build $1 billion or capitalize on $1 billion opportunity. And, you know, we have examples of that. So for instance, our very first investment out of fund is a company called Maven, which is a mobile distribution platform for hairstylists in communities of color. And
Use the product?
I do not use the product.
Okay, me neither.
I probably should use the product, right? Yeah, they started out with hair extensions and weaves.
Oh, right? Perfect.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I probably should use it. But the challenge that they were trying to address is that in most of these hair salons, they're almost break even to just a little bit above break even businesses. So they can't afford to carry inventory risk. Right. Because, you know, you buy more of a product than you need. You might go out. You might not be able to pay your bills that month and you could go out of business. So Maven figured out a way to take on that inventory risk for them and then also allow the hairstylist to get a piece of the cut when that hair is sold. And they do it in a really convenient way through mobile. And now you have hairstylists that are making, you know, maybe 20,000 more per year out of their business because now they can actually sell the products.
That's
a $9 billion market, right? That nobody else thought of before he did.
That's crazy. Well, you tie that concept of that sort of something that's a little bit more original. And we talked before about like almost like the copycat syndrome. Like we're going to make the Latin version of Uber, or we're going to make the Black version of Airbnb. Like what's, you know, how do you identify the difference between those two opportunities as even as a, let's say I'm starting out as a founder and I'm starting to develop ideas. Like where do you look to as an investor, and how do you advise people on not being a copycat and finding that originality?
Like, is it truly different, right? So, you know, the Lyft for Black people is not really different than Lyft, right? And
your cousin giving you a ride to the airport?
Yeah, it's not very different, right? So it's like, what, solve something new that hasn't been tackled yet, or do it in a very different way. So I was telling you, I just came back from Nairobi. We have a portfolio company there. I'm not going to talk about our portfolio company. I'm going to talk about another company that I met while I was there. And I visited this town called Cabrera, and they tag it as the second largest slum in the world, right? So just to set up the visual for you, you're talking about, you know, dirt roads with craters in it, you know, homes that are stacked really close together that are maybe, you know, 4x6 and are made out of zinc. Basically no running water, maybe a little bit of electricity. But you have these talented artisans that make jewelry and other products. So I met this company called Soko that basically created a mobile platform that allows these artisans to sell their products to internationally, either direct to consumer over the internet or, you know, by bulk order from like an Anthropology and stuff like that. And what's really interesting about this company and that country is that as poor as it is, everyone has a cell phone, and they run the entire process through the cell phone. And so now you have some of these artisans that grew up in like the severest of you know, impoverished situations that are now able to move their families out of those slums, building homes. Going to sending their children to better schools and all this stuff. And that's like, you know, that's looking at something that was within that community that had significant value, but wasn't being monetized properly or capitalized on. And they found a unique way to do that. Like, I want to see stuff like that.
That's a great example. Have you seen anything similar in the U.S., right? You know, I think we can sometimes look at a developing country as those folks over there, but there's a similar model that can be adapted here. And have you seen that, especially like in a city like L.A., you know, anything come to mind?
There's a bunch. One easy one, well, we already talked about Maven, but another easy one for us is a company called Wonder School, which is the Airbnb of early childhood care, right? So you hear Airbnb. But it's not a copycat in the sense that it's not where Airbnb allowed people to turn their homes into hotel rooms. They're allowing people to turn their homes into daycare facilities. And what's great about that is it's tackling a real problem in diverse communities in the sense that there is most of the time there isn't affordable, you know, high value education. And so now they're through this platform, they're able to administer a consistent curriculum across the board, irrespective of where you live, and make it at a price point that's affordable based on where you live.
I grew up in Michigan, right? In Detroit. Anybody from Detroit? Yeah, no. All right, there you go. And there was, I used to caddy at a country club, and some of the richest people I met, like, did nuts and bolts businesses. They would have, you know, I make fabric for interior cars, and, you know, billionaire. Where I think coastally in LA, we celebrate the sensationalized entertainment, you know, like bigger, shiny objects. But that proximity based, you know, what is the culture that's closest to me? How do you advise people to look at those things that are close versus the shinier objects that everybody else is talking about?
I just boil it down to how can you create real value, right? If it I like the big opportunities too, so how do you create real value, and how do you spend your time working on something that you're uniquely qualified and capable of working on? Because that that is a real advantage. I'll give you an example of a company that did this poorly. Y'all probably heard of the company called Bodega. Did y'all see that in the tech blogs and all that stuff? So they were creating basically vending machines that they were going to use to replace. I grew up in New York, so I don't know if everyone knows what a bodega is, but it's like a corner store where in the community where you get your eggs, your milk, everything you need. It's also kind of a hangout spot. But the thing with how they approached it is they were going to use these vending machines to eradicate or get rid of bodegas, which are a staple in the community. So had they, you know, talked to people from the communities that they're looking to install these things in, they would have learned a lot more about the value and the why these facilities are needed. And they probably would have taken an approach where we'll make bodegas more efficient, or we'll help them, you know, run better.
Well, in that case, whatever. How important is an advisor, right? And I think there's sometimes where it's like there's a little bit of cultural insensitivity in that example. It's like, oh, you don't want to get rid of this spot. You know, they're just tone deaf or whatever. But I think through good advice, good counsel, how does the founder seek that out, right?
But still,
be self-checked in that way.
There is that, right? Mm-hmm. But I would implore the people in those communities to be the ones to go in and build it. Like, you live it. There's a difference between lived experience and reading about something in a book or talking about something with someone. Like, that's a clear advantage. If you live this thing every day, if you're experiencing this struggle, you are uniquely qualified to bring a solution to solve it.
Well, in my book that just came out.
No plug there.
Crushing the Box, 10 Essential Rules for Breaking Essential Rules, available only on Amazon. The first chapter actually talks about empathy. It's that exact thing, right? Like, going there and being part of whatever community you're trying to affect. Like, the idea may be a good one on the surface, vending machine to replace, but sure. But to go and live in that environment for a minute, how much of that happens in your day-to-day? I mean, you have a portfolio of 26 companies, and when you're trying to make a decision about which ones we're going to support or be a part of, you know, how much of that cultural empathy do you go deliberately seek out?
So, you know, when you're investing at the early stage,
book is a number one seller, by the way, just so you know.
you have some here. Did you bring some?
I'm sorry. It's one in my bag. Go. Continue.
Yeah. we invest at the seed stage, right? And the thing about investing at the seed stage is that the idea, the company that you're investing in at that point is likely going to change two, maybe three times before it realizes its potential. So what we're really betting on is the opportunity and the people that are driving this opportunity forward. And so we always look for what is that unique thing, that thing that's really unique to you that makes you super qualified to do this thing, right? So I mentioned Maven earlier. Well, Deshaun grew up in a household of women hairstylists. He also lived in China teaching English to the Chinese students for a while and learned the import-export business. There's no one better qualified to do a logistics company, cross-border type stuff between China and the U.S. that's focused on hairstylists. So those are the things that we look
for. Yeah, I had a chance to interview Miguel McKelvey, the founder of WeWork. And, WeWork is massive. People can argue the business case if you want to or not. But, you know, he grew up in a commune. Like, he grew up in a house where it was his mom and her two best friends and their kids. And they all just sort of shared resources. And, of course, that emulates in what WeWork is. It's like, it's a community, not just an office space. So, you know, finding that thing that's in you and that's, you know, a part of your own DNA that can be outwardly developed into a business.
Yeah, I'll give you another one. So LA-based company, Thrive Market. That's kind of an online grocer focused on, high quality foods that are organic and good for you. Was founded by a gentleman named Gennar Lovelace, who grew up on a commune in Ojai, single parent household, that struggle to put food on the table, struggle to find high quality food. So this was a mission that he was very passionate about and lived through. And you could see that in all the work that they do at Thrive Market.
Before we close, let's just talk a little bit about leadership. You know, obviously you got birthed in a lot of really interesting places, including, you know, Intel Capital. But what is your superpower? You know, as a leader, when you walk into a room or you're, you know, working with the companies and the individuals that you're working with, what's that one thing that, you know, Marlon brings to the table from a superpower standpoint?
It's so many. I'm joking.
Bring me my cape.
Yeah. No, I think the thing that would probably set me apart from other investors is I really take pride in putting myself in other people's shoes. So trying to see whatever we're talking about from your perspective. I think empathy is a really, really important characteristic and attribute of a leader.
Where do the resources go? Right. You know, you identified a lane, and when you were at Intel, you said, hey, I want to do this and identify these entrepreneurs, but in the grand scheme of thing, where does the money flow? And also, how do you overcome that? How do you overcome the giant hurdle like a WeWork in that example?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's first of all, not enough money flows to our communities. Right. And particularly in venture capital, is it 2% of venture capital decision makers are Black men. And if you go to Black women, it's probably like 0.2%. And the Latinas are even worse off, right? And so that's reflected in the number of diverse founded companies that are funded, because it's a natural thing, and good people try to fight through it. But it's a natural thing to want to work with people that look and come from the same communities and act in the same ways that you do. But when one group is holding the bag, that becomes a problem. So, you know, I can only speak about like what we did, right? We identified a lane that we were, again, uniquely qualified to play in. And we started playing in that lane and outperformed everybody that might even come close to our lane. And it kind of took care of itself.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Marlon. Yeah. Give it up for Marlon Nichols, Cross Culture Ventures.